And now, the exciting conclusion of Junk Food Cinema, The Blob, with special guest Joe Lynch, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
Hi, this is Chuck Russell, director of The Blob, and you're watching Junk Food Cinema.
Hey, who the hell are these guys and who gave them a copy of my film?
Hey guys, it's Chuck Russell. I heard you were covering my movie, The Blob, for your Summer of 88 series, and I'm thrilled. It was a tough, wonderful shoot with some of the most ambitious physical effects, most of them full scale, no CGI, it's all the real thing. So I hope you guys enjoy it. And listen, by the way, Joe Lynch seems like a nice guy, but if you've seen his movie, Mayhem, you might want to think twice about being locked in a studio with him. Just saying.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall, a splotch, a blotch.
Because I know that, like, this is going to be a supersized episode. We've only talked about maybe 5% of this movie. Like I said before, this movie has definitely influenced me. It really changed my perception of what filmmaking was, you know, and everybody has one, you know, and it doesn't, like, I know that there's the go-tos, you know, there's the Citizen Kanes for a certain generation. There's the Apocalypse Now for other generations, the Pulp Fictions. And
yeah,
stuff.
But every filmmaker that I've met has some oddball film, and it's always some weird film.
Yeah, believe me, I never in a million years would have thought, you know, even when I saw The Blob the first time, that I would say, Chuck Russell's The Blob is a touchstone film for me. Like, I'm not going to, you know, sit at the DGA or be at the Academy Awards and say, and thank you to The Blob. I might, you never know. But it's just, it's one of those movies that I remember there being this seismic shift in the way that I watched movies. And, you know, that was an education that was fueled on Starlog and Fango and Cine Fantastique. And, you know, back in the old days when they would have like those old... Oh, Jesus.
Oh, wait,
really?
You said Starlog. Sorry. Oh. I misunderstood.
Hey, hold on one second. I might point out that we are about to re-enter the Fango days. If for those of you listening who have not found out, they are relaunching Fangoria. A bunch of your favorite online writers are all contributing. They're approaching writers and directors of horror films. It is going to be a wonderful, interesting relaunch. We may be re-entering the era of the Badass magazine.
Oh, I hope so. The thing that Fango really cultivated in so many fans and so many artists is the craft, is being able to step back, because so many moments in all these movies that we grew up with were either truncated by the MPAA or, for one reason or another, just, you know, left to mere frames. When you'd see, like, all the hard work that your Rob Bottins and your Rick Bakers and your Tony Gardners and your Rob Bottins, you know, like all those guys who, you know, like put their heart, soul, and coke into all of that work.
I love that you said you wanted to say Rob Bottin twice.
I know, I couldn't help myself.
And I just wanted to go full Blazing Saddles and go, you said Rob Bottin twice.
Sorry.
I like Rob Bottin.
Rob Bottin deserves two mentions in most cases. All right, so really quick. So yes, you know, this movie was very influential to me, but weirdly enough, the movie has kind of weaved its way in and out of my life multiple times where, you know, again, I feel like I've seen the movie so many times that I know all the credits. Like, I remember driving into New York City trying to, like, find, because if you remember New York City and back in the 80s, you know, or even now, like, they would put, like, multiple posters all over construction sites and everything. And I duped my mom into saying, yeah, I want to go see A Chorus Line. I really wanted to go into the city and pull off one of those posters. And after a while, I became so obsessed with it throughout the day that my mom was like, fine, I'll help you. But we couldn't actually do it. So she paid off a video store dude. She like went to the video store and said, whenever this movie comes out on video, I'm giving you $20. Save me the video poster for it. Unfortunately, the poster from the video was decidedly different than the one that was the one from the movie theater. So it kind of fucking bummed me out. But anyway, it was in my room forever. So when I first came out here, sorry, go ahead.
No. Go for it.
When I first came out to LA, one of the first jobs that I had was for this kid show called How Is It Made? And one of the guest stars on the show was Patton Oswalt. That's how I met Patton. That's how Patton ended up being in Wrong Turn 2. And also this guy who produced this show lived in Ventura, California. He lived next to Hoyt Yateman. And Hoyt Yateman was the visual effects supervisor on The Blob. So the guy comes in one day. I'm like editing this kid show. And he's like, oh, here, meet my friend Hoyt. Again, because I had that poster in my bedroom and I saw that name, I was like, you did The Blob. And the guy's toupee must have flown off of his fucking head. I don't think he expected ever to hear that phrase ever. So I ended up spending like a week just picking his brain about how did they make The Blob? How did you do the effects? And it was amazing. So there's that. Bill Moseley. I worked with Bill Moseley, who plays soldier number 2 in this movie. He's the guy with the bazooka, you know, down. And what's weird is that I remember watching the movie and going, is that Chop Top from Texas Chainsaw? That's weird. He's not as crazy, so it can't be him. I legitimately thought that Bill Moseley was just crazy, so it could not have hit. How could he play a scientist? But yep, that was Bill Moseley, so I worked with him. Chuck Russell. So like I mentioned, Chuck Russell and I became fast friends because of the Masters of Horror dinners. Sorry, let me collect all these names. Hold on, I got a few more.
I'm just looking at Cargill look, the load is being lifted off of his shoulders this week.
It's nothing. Joe once had a tweet storm about being at a Guillermo del Toro dinner, in which he dropped so many names. Oh, it put me to shame.
Sorry.
This is the great thing about being in Cargill's brand new house, is that the floor, you can actually walk across it without tripping over all the names
has
dropped. Like, it is a brand new floor. How are you going to fill this place up with all the names?
Because it's twice as big as the last house.
How strange and sinister that is. Sorry, I'm getting that all out of the
way. Hold on. Did you just success drop as a preamble to name dropping? Because that is next level dropping.
I will point out that my last house was super fucking tiny. It was a goddamn postage stamp, but I lived there for 10 years and never bitched about it. But you've been there, Joe. You've stayed there. Yeah. You stayed on my super small fold-out bed.
Which folds out of a... Okay, sidebar. Folded out of what looked like a cabinet that you would keep like
porn
towels in, but had a bed inside of it. I was always it's like a TARDIS that you make guests sleep on.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
Yeah. Way so, time on
so
that.
So yes, this place is twice as big as a postage stamp.
I'll be there tomorrow.
So the guest room may have an actual full size bed.
The guest room will have a full size bed this time
around.
As long as you have a porch and there are drinks.
Oh, dude, the porch. I am right next to the porch right now. We will probably record from the porch at times. It is glorious.
Oh, man. All right. Well.
Okay. So I want to play a quick game because you're dropping a lot of knowledge about this movie, which I expected you to do. But in order for me to make sure that I'm running down everything that I have based on the tireless work of our research team, I want to play a little game called Shut Up, Joe. I'm asking Cargill. And this is a trivia game where I'm going to ask Cargill trivia questions about The Blob, and when he can't answer it, then I will begrudgingly let Joe answer the question.
Which is probably most of these questions. So allow me to fail.
No, what's going to suck is that I'm going to screw this all up. I don't like this game.
All right. So The Blob, as we mentioned, a lot of practical effects in this movie. The Blob was made of methicil, which is used to thicken gravy, and what fast food milkshake?
Joe?
McDonald's.
That is correct! You already beat me to the Bill Moseley one. That's what inspired me to start doing this game. So Frank Darabont first met Chuck Russell in 1981 while working as a production assistant on what film?
Joe.
Oh, fuck. Not The Boogeyman, is it?
I will give you a hint, Joe. Linda Blair.
Savage Streets?
Go back further.
Fuck. Damn it.
Oh, wait. Is this Exorcist 2?
No. No, what is it? Shit.
Night.
Oh, Hell Knight. God damn it. That's the thing.
They were both production assistants on Hell Knight?
Apparently.
Okay, Cargill. Name one of the two Playboy Playmates in The Blob.
Oh, God damn it. Joe.
Erica Laniak.
That is correct.
Oh, shit.
I knew that too fast.
Wait, no. See, I didn't realize that was her. Holy shit, that is her.
Because she's asleep half the time?
Yeah. But so those of you out there have to understand, Erica Liniak is one of the few Playboy Playmates in the 80s who actually escaped just being a Playboy Playmate and had done other stuff. And she'd actually done stuff beforehand. Like, she was a young girl in E.T. So by the time she was – I think she's like Pretty Girl or something like that in the credits. But she – She ended up being a Playboy Playmate that was really big and is most notable. I mean, she was in a bunch of stuff after that, but most notable in the 90s as being the girl who jumps out of the cake in Under Siege. And she did a number of noteworthy movies to where you couldn't just call her a Playboy Playmate. But oh my God, I didn't realize that was her.
I think she's my favorite actress. Way to jump out of that cake. All right. So
wait, really quick. With that scene with Paul and Vicky, if you ever watch it again, think It Follows, because it's almost like that there's an It Follows homage in The Blob 20 years or 25 years before It Follows.
Wait, no, that's not called an homage. That's called another film homaging that film.
I highly doubt that It Follows is ever going to say that The Blob is a reference.
Look, Joe, that's an homage in the same way that 1990 Bronx Warriors is an homage to the Warriors.
Okay.
Let's call a spade here. I also just want to point out really quickly, let's talk about that scene for just a second. In your proposed remake, Joe, did you have a character who had a rape trunk? Was that something
the movie gets a little rapey. I if anything, I would have loved to have seen the deleted scene where they showed Paul's preparation. It's almost like a line cook, you know, like preparing that trunk. Because that is a pretty intricate trunk with the strawberries and the fake rings. Like, he's on a mission.
Yeah, but the beauty of it in true Russell Darabont fashion is he's being judged for that. He's not a hero.
Oh,
no
way.
He's going to get one of those satisfying deaths. Like, there's so many characters in this movie that you're not allowed to enjoy their death because you really like those characters and it's so brutal. And then this is the fun one. This is the one where this douchebag fucking gets his comeuppance. And
yeah, the reckoning is definitely well deserved.
They fucking crank him to 11 in terms of date rapey douchebag.
In 1988, I think we all would have assumed that's very Willie Ames of him. In 2018, yeah, we now know that's very Scott Baio of him.
Oh my God. The tables have turned.
Charles is not in charge.
You just got zapped!
Yeah, it's the weirdest thing. The guy we always thought would be the date rapist turned out to be the Bible thumper, and the guy we thought was the good kid next door was the child rapist. What the fuck?
Turns out, nobody loves Chachi. So you pegged – oh, my God, what a terrible sentence. You correctly guessed Erica Laniak. Can you name, for bonus points, Joe, the other playmate that's in the movie?
Oh, fuck, there was another playmate. Oh, shit.
There was.
Oh, God.
I will give you a hint. She plays Susie.
Oh, Christ. Sorry. My Playboy acumen is not up to par.
That's okay. That just means you're not as creepy as the two of us. Julie McCullough is the other one.
Oh, Julie McCullough.
The two of us. You're the one who knows the name of Playboy Playmates. I didn't even think that was a question we would ask.
Again, researchers.
What's Playboy?
It's a magazine that used to exist that maybe they'll restart for old school fans.
No, for the millennial crew.
This is a pretty great segue to the next question, because Candy Clark, who is somehow not a Playboy Playmate, auditioned for what classic film role that we all know and love that she didn't get?
Carrie?
You're so close, it's ridiculous.
Jesus Christ.
Joe.
The mom from Cat's Eye?
Okay, you motherfuckers. Here's a hint. She was nominated for an Oscar for American Graffiti. If that helps you at all. Which was directed by
her pivotal role in Blue Thunder.
God damn it, Joe.
Just fucking like
it's Princess Leia, you fuckers.
Okay.
She auditioned for Princess Leia.
Okay.
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 Oh my god. I made that happen. Oh, I'm so happy right now. Oh god, your Denzel Washington was second to none. Holy shit, that was so good.
And finally, what
sorry, just to steamroll over my blowjob.
That's it. No. Please segue into blowing us at any given time.
Yeah, no, go for it. I this will be the last one. What 80s television mainstay who is now a cultural joke was in the running for the role of Brian Flagg?
Oh, now I'm thinking it's fucking Gerald in charge.
Bill Cosby? No,
it's well, you see, the thing about I don't identify with Brian Flagg. I like the guy.
It's all a lie.
I like the guy with the trunk with the things. No, it was Richard Grieco. Richard Grieco was in the running apparently to play Brian Flagg. So there you have it. That was a round of Shut Up Cargill. I was asking Joe.
Speaking of flags, there's a lot of stand references in this movie.
There are.
Darabont being a big Stephen King fan. You have Flag. You have Can Man. The whole viral thing. I mean, clearly Darabont was kind of putting the seeds that he wanted to be the greatest Stephen King adaptation person of all time in this movie. Maybe he was like a little bit of a calling card.
I kind of imagine him sitting in that hotel room with Russell wearing that Andre Gower's red Stephen King's rule shirt.
By the way.
Really quick. All right. So remember before I was saying, you know, there's 6 degrees of Joe Lynch when it comes to the Blob. So flash forward to 2015, and I am directing a music video for my favorite band of all time, Faith No More. And, you know, they reached out to me. They knew I was a big fan. I was like I still am one of the biggest fans. And, you know, whenever you get a chance to work with your favorite band of all time, you say yes.
Wait, what's your favorite band?
The Faith No More.
What is it?
Oh, I really stepped into that. Sorry.
Yes.
Excuse me while I have a midlife crisis. Anyway, so I'm excited to do this video, but then they go, oh, by the way, we can't be in it. I'm like, oh, fuck. What are we going to do? So I came up with this idea that they were old people in a nursing home playing a video. Sorry, Dave Grohl, you totally ripped me off. But I digress. We had to cast all these different actors as each member of the band. So, you know, we were not union. We had no money, and it was just like, it was a 1-day shoot, but we put it out there. My producer, Sarah Elbert, put a word out there, and we got all these amazing actors who came in, and they self-taped and everything. And I basically picked and choose from the self-tapes. I barely remember the names. So they came and we started shooting, and I noticed the bass player looked so familiar. I could not put my finger on it. And then midway through the day, it was just like a lightning bolt hit me. I walked over to him and I said, "Are you the guy in the spacesuit Jennings from The Blob?" And in fact, it was.
What?
It's the guy. His name is Robert Axelrod. He's the guy that's like the kind of second in command. He's the one who's always going like, "I don't know if we should do this. Oh, there's a pandemic. This could turn America. You're like, this could destroy America in 2 days." That guy, exposition, ended up just by fucking chance, ended up being in my Faith No More music video, which. That music video turned out so well that that's the reason why there's a Faith No More song in Mayhem. So
no shit.
There's some fucking hidden guns for you right there, baby.
It's the more you talk about this. Okay. You need to remake The Blob. this is just a moral imperative at this point. So it hasn't been done yet. It may have gone to someone else, but it seems to be much like the blob at the end of this movie, sitting in a jar on a shelf. So look,
I'll say it right now. Like, the only person who's been attached for years has been Sam Jackson. I'll motherfucking make a motherfucking blob movie with motherfucking Sam Jackson in a motherfucking heartbeat.
Is he attached to play the scientist?
I don't motherfucking care. He could be attached to motherfucking play the motherfucking blob. There's some motherfucking humans in my motherfucking self right now. I don't care. Like,
wait, no, you know what the scene needs to be? He needs to give that rallying speech, and then the blob comes out of nowhere and snatches him up.
Oh,
no, no. I'm gonna lose Sam Jackson for the entire second act, and then the blob's gonna come out, and just when you think he's gonna kill someone, Sam Jackson's gonna come out and snatch the blob and pull that motherfucker underwater. That's how I'm gonna fucking switch shit up.
I like it.
Yes,
I like it so
much.
That's
some progressive shit right there. But yeah, like the movie's been kicking around for years, and I do check in with it. I am shameless, but like hopefully by the time the next project finishes, and then maybe the next one after that, and I my foreign market value is better or whatever it's gonna fucking take. But that I feel like the script that they have in development is very relevant for the times. I think it's, you know, what's funny is that the pitch that I kind of went in with it was Out of the Furnace with a Monster. And if you remember that movie Out of the Furnace with Christian Bale, it's like the difference in small town America has changed drastically in 2018. And the way that they've woven the blob mythos into that world, or at least today's world, is just as salient as it was back in the 80s and then back to the 50s. It is definitely a reflection of ourselves, and it makes the monster movie relevant again, you know, and whether or not that director does it, who knows, but yeah, like I miss the monster movie, and I'm watching this movie again. It's like, I do miss the days where, you know, there was this glee in watching a monster movie, and it fucking affect you, not just because of the effects, but because of the characters. The characters in this movie are so well defined. And, you know, one of the things that we've kind of danced around a little bit is, you know, by the time you get to the third act of the film, the movie is balancing three or four dishes between what's happening in the town square, what's happening in the sewers, what's happening at the lab, or like the kind of military bunker. All these different things are about to converge, and the way that Darabont and Russell balance those structures so that when they finally come to that moment at the end when, you know, Bill Moseley just happens to have a bazooka and Kevin Dillon sticks it up Joe Seneca's ass, so to speak, it's cathartic because it feels like then you have this amazing Mexican showdown, and the tension and the suspense is so palpable because we've now watched all three or four of these different factions of storylines all converge in a perfectly balanced way. And the stakes have been raised so that we don't know what the fuck is going to happen. So that by the time we get to, you know, small town America being torn to shreds by this thing, It feels like a true big climax for a movie that wasn't really a big movie back in 1988, you know, but it the weight behind it, and the music is so fucking great at that point. Like, everything feels like it's been set up perfectly and pays off really, really well.
I couldn't agree more. And one of the things I think is great is, if you want a lesson in screenwriting 101, it's the fact that they set this movie in a ski town in the off season. Because if cold is going to be the thing that ruins the blob, and the blob shows up in the ski town in the winter, movie's over in 5 minutes. However, you can't – the idea that any town in America could just weaponize cold is absurd. However, a winter town with ski slopes, as we've learned in movies like, I don't know, Frozen – The idea that they have these machines that can help.
Wait, the Disney movie?
Yes. Yeah. You know, I've made that joke before. Let it go. The fact that they have these things that create snow is a real thing. So it's amazing that they jump through all these hoops to be like, it's not just the fact that we can have ghost town streets and establish an eerie vibe at the beginning of the movie. We're going to set it here because specifically they're going to have to figure out the weakness of thing of this thing and then realize that they have the capacity to take it out with what they have here in town. It is so bloody brilliant. And the fact that they went out of their way
so well set up without making you know it's set up. Like that's
exactly
like, that's some old school Zemeckis Gale shit where you have to see the movie again to go, oh my God, they set up the whole ribbed condoms thing and the bridge. The fucking kid's zipper has an arc, for Christ's sakes. Like there are things in that are embedded in the script that are not huge moments that I think are almost like exploited ad nauseum now in big blockbusters where it's like, hey, look at this. This is going to pay off later, where you don't even realize that the whole snow element and that whole big snow truck is even going to come back. It just kind of unfolds when he, you know, when Kevin Dillon's character goes into his shop and is just kind of hanging out with his boss. It's so thrown away. But then when it comes back and you see Kevin Dillon driving that thing and you have that almost like Alan Silvestri kind of score cue coming up with all the drums and it passes by Snowmaker, you're like, fuck this. Mulletron 2000 is in effect.
Well, and that's Darabont and Russell for you. I mean, this is every scene in this movie that does that pulls double duty. They're always doing one thing and distracting you like a magic trick, and then adding in a small detail or two that you're like, oh, okay, this is just filler for the scene, but it is them burying guns, and they bury guns all over this place. I mean, it is this first act sets up everything that happens in the third act. Every major character arc, every major thing is right there. And it is so masterfully done.
I just realized that I want to write a screenplay called Buried Guns, which is the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of every movie we've ever loved, where guys are just wafting through the first act of like 20 different movies and going, huh, wonder what that's there for. Anyway, let's have a conversation. Huh. You see that guy did that? That's interesting.
I learned buried. I don't know where this term came from. I had not heard it until this podcast. And then I literally just had a writing session on this new project I'm on. And I mentioned the buried guns thing. And a very well-known writer was like, what the fuck are you talking about? And when I explained it, he goes, that's fucking brilliant. Where did that come from? When I explained it, he goes,
It comes from Chuck Palahniuk.
Never heard that term before, but it's like, but those are the things that like I mentioned, I used to call them Zemeckis Gale moments, where you would just have these almost innocuous plot points or character moments or details that are embedded in like the first act that you don't even realize. They wash over you just like every other detail. And then they come back and it's almost like the film is prodding you to check in and say, have you been watching? And if you have, here's a little treat, because there's nothing better than when you feel like you are in symbiosis with the film, you know, like when you're on the same wavelength and you're like caught up with it. Because then when moments like that happens, like, you know, like for perfect examples, that moment, you know, Ribbed plays the pharmacist and also Shawnee Smith's dad, you know, has this moment where he meets Donovan Leitch for the first time. And it's a perfectly constructed levity beat in an otherwise genre movie where his buddy goes to get the condoms. He doesn't even realize that they're talking about him or the condoms, but the audience does. So that when he walks in and you get that moment Ribbed, it's so funny, because it's even funnier because he doesn't even realize what they're talking about, unless his buddy told him, which I highly doubt. He was too worried about making cocktails.
And that great bit where they look over at him, he's like, come on, man, this girl's not going to wait all night. And he's talking about the girl he's going on a date with, not the girl the condoms are being bought for.
The script is fucking great. Like, it is a masterclass in elevating genre. I know everyone talks about that these days, or elevated genre. Yeah, but when you have guys like Chuck and you have guys like Frank, who, like you were saying before, their love and affinity for Jack Harris and their love and affinity for monster movies and 50s horror and knowing all the buttons. Because if you can look at all the buttons on your soundboard, much like Brian is doing right now, trying to wait for another Stargrove to be implemented, there it is. Dodge hidden guns.
Dot misdirect.
But when you know those buttons, you know that, like, just like what you did, you know that if you push something completely different, you were going to get kind of almost like a postmodern kind of response out of that, or a laugh out of that. These guys knew the tropes so well that they knew, oh, you know that kids don't die in these movies. Nope, sorry, fuck you. You know, it's like they're subtly giving you these wonderful fuck you moments that are callbacks, but also they're rewards for loving the genre so much that you want something a little different. And that's what The Blob gives you.
I agree 1,000%. And by the way, welcome back to Buried Guns, the podcast where we only talk about the first act of Young Guns and Young Guns 2. On this week's episode...
In this week's episode, we're doing Two Guns.
Hey, that's a good movie.
It really
is. To that, I must
say...
Take
a drink, Junkions.
Okay!
Okay!
Okay.
And that brings us to, possibly, the most dangerous junk food pairing of all time, because Joe actually messaged me and said, oh, I've got the junk food pairing on lock, which I think is the big dangerous thing about this, because but to be fair, I think what I was going to do for this show was probably more dangerous, which is that I was going to make that actual strawberry cocktail, which is mostly NyQuil, and then see if I could make it all the way to the end of the show after drinking a couple of those. So
I think I honestly think this should be the easiest junk food pairing of all time. There's just no reason for it not to be.
That being said, Cargill, guest honor. So go ahead, Joe. What is the junk food pairing?
Well, no, I want to know first off, this is a perfect example of knowing and loving a certain thing and then wanting to subvert it a little bit. So go ahead, Cargill. What do you think is the perfect junk food pairing?
I mean, really, it's cherry Jell-O.
Okay. All right. Oh, okay.
I mean, first of all, it shows that there's a great gag in the movie involving
great
cherry
segue,
Jell-O.
Good editing.
It's the fucking Blob.
Yes. I would say, yes, that would make sense, wouldn't it? I would go a step further. I'm going to say Jell-O with popcorn in it.
Jell-O with, to represent all the pieces of Peeps that have been assimilated?
No, I actually tried this out. Originally, it was going to be a popcorn and jelly sandwich. And this is something
that's what
that
you
I
told me.
Tried.
And I was like, whoa, he's already subverting my expectations.
For this very show, because I wanted to see what it's like. But if you think about it, it's like we're all, especially now since fucking Whiplash, everyone is obsessed with dropping sweet shit in their popcorn. I get it. It's totally fine. The whole kettle corn thing totally works. But there are moments, especially... There is the image of that poor girl in the movie theater, in The Blob, that movie theater scene when she is pulled off of the carpet and you just see the carpet and the gore and the kind of blobbiness and the popcorn that are all stuck together. That was, aside from the kid, Cargo, what you were saying before, one of those like indelible images that has haunted me forever. That's definitely one of them, because that was like, the movies to me was my sanctuary. That was my safe spot. Even when I would watch dangerous things like dangerous movies for the longest time, and unfortunately now that's unfortunately changed for a whole generation, but movies to me were my safe spot. So whenever a movie did that where they would encroach on my safe spot, you're messing with my domain. And The Blob did that, but did it in the best way possible. So that image of like jelly and popcorn mixing together has always stuck with me. So I thought, all right, there's got to be two things. It's either got to be a popcorn and jelly sandwich or popcorn Jell-O, which you can easily make by dropping popcorn into your Jell-O mix. Trust me, it actually works. And you get that nice sweet and salty taste. Or ribs.
Oh, I guess ribs.
I mean, come on. It's like, oh, by the way, you owe Chuck Russell some barbecue for the messages. I'm just
Well, that's okay. Saying. I live like 3 minutes away from the county line now, so I can take him on down.
If I would, because I don't know if Chuck's listening to this or not, I mentioned this to him, and he was like, oh, and then he like hung up and then just sent those two messages. So that there's his response. But I want to give a shout out to Chuck. Not only did he make a movie that really affected me, and I say this to all other filmmakers, all of us, it's like, you never know what movie or what project you're doing is going to seismically change someone's life. you know, how many jobs that we have out there where we make choices and do things and make things that will change someone. I don't think in 1988, Chuck was going like, I'm going to change some kid's life. And here I am today. Well, that happened, you know. So just filmmakers out there, just know you have a responsibility out there. And the stuff that you make, be passionate about it, because you are going to change people's lives. Doesn't matter what the subject matter is. It doesn't have to be a Holocaust drama. It could be a fucking monster. But the big thing for me is, so last year when I finished Mayhem, and this was right around the time, right before South by Southwest was going to be the premiere. And I was as broke as a fucking joke. I was in a really bad shape, because look, when you're making independent movies, you're not making a lot of money, and that money went very fast, very quickly, like it was gone. So I was kind of looking for work. I didn't know what to do. So I was just randomly at a screening for Logan, and my phone was buzzing. So I looked really quick, and it said Charles Russell. I'm like, get the fuck out of here. No, it can't be that guy. So I didn't get the call. And afterwards I left and I picked up the phone, and it was Chuck Russell. And he remembered that I was, I guess, into editing or whatever. And he was asking me, he was doing this project, one of like five projects that he's been doing in the last couple of years. The guy is a fucking machine. But he was working on this one project, and they were in like the middle of the shoot, and they had to shut down production because of like weather or something like that. And they had enough footage to cut something together for the Cannes Film Festival. Do I know anybody who would be willing to cut together something from 16 days of dailies? And I'm sitting there, and again, like I'm broke and I don't have a job. I don't know what's coming next. I thought at that point, I honestly thought I better find a job as soon as possible, because when this movie plays, my fucking career is over. So I need to find something. And I was like, I'll do it. And he's like, really? You would do this? I'm like, yeah, fuck yeah, I would. So thus began 6 weeks of me and Chuck together working on this secret little project. And guys, like, very rarely do we ever get a chance to work with people that have changed our lives like that. And Chuck not only taught me so many things about his own craft and his own, you know, like the method to his own madness, but and the stories of just the industry back then, today, and everything. But he employed me for 6 weeks, cutting this trailer together, which was, again, you know, I can't really talk about the details of it. It's fucking crazy, and it was dailies, 16 days where I had to sit there and sync up 16 days worth of footage and create like a little mini version of this movie. So to sit down with like one of my childhood heroes every day for 6 weeks, and it was a delight, and I learned so much from it. And honestly, like, he kept me afloat. This was like the nascent days of the Movie Crypt Patreon thing. So we weren't getting any money from there. I had no income coming in, and Chuck Russell saved my life. I'm going to just say that right now. So I owe a lot to this fucking man. And and I owe a lot to this movie. So Chuck Russell, seriously, sorry to go long-winded on it, but
that's okay. We'll edit that down.
Good, good. It'll just be like, let me talk about Chuck Russell. And that was Chuck Russell.
That was a 30-minute rant that you guys just heard in 4 minutes.
Hold on.
Mara, cut all the sappy shit out. Thank you.
Great. That's just great. You know, those are things that I haven't even talked about on my own podcast, The Movie Crypt. So
The Movie Crypt.
And by the way, guys, thank you so much for being so supportive of us. You know how much we love you guys. I know Adam doesn't listen to many, many podcasts, own any podcasts. Sorry, I take the M out, any. But I do. And your podcast has been one that has gotten me through some crazy shit. So thank you for doing
it. Well, I mean, you guys have been so supportive of us, and you guys have been supportive of me. You guys have done the greatest interview with me that has been done. And it always tickles me when a Cargill joke sneaks in every once in a while.
Oh, they do. Oh, they definitely do.
And I got to say, Joe, what you've just described about, you know, no matter what you make and the ripples and how it affects people, you have your own fish story. Like, that's what's going on there, is the whole idea that whatever you make at some point in someone's life is going to resonate and make a difference. And I think it's phenomenal that you have a real life fish story with The Blob going on. So
Oh, I thought that when I listened to the Deep Dish this morning. I mean, I'm so glad that you guys are talking about, you know, Fissure Story.
Fissure Story.
Oh, I love that movie. But again, that is full of, you know, these things that we make. You know, I learned so much from the Serbian crew who did both Everly and Mayhem, where, you know, they were so gracious in wanting to make stuff, because there's very few jobs out there where you can make a creative decision, blue over yellow, and that decision will be seen by millions of people. Like, that's insanity. And there are people that are in this industry that take that for granted, or they're jaded by it, or they just don't even think about it. But then there's others who they take great pride in that. And, you know, any film fan or even any filmmaker, look at The Blob, whether you've seen it for the first time, or you've seen it for the 20th time, like I have, watch the craft involved. And a lot of times these movies, you know, there's always like, while the script kind of sucks, the effects are amazing. Or while the script's brilliant, like the acting is so wooden and the effects are kind of down, you know, like dated or whatever. I challenge anyone, other than a few kind of crappy opticals that for one reason or another just, you know, don't stand the test of time, I challenge anybody to say that The Blob is not a very structurally sound script, that the acting across the board isn't servicing that script, and if anything, going above and beyond the call of duty. The effects do not, you know, do not seem dated at all. If anything, you know, still seem as effective, if not more effective, by CG standards. If you've ever seen, like, you know, any kind of blob-like substance, like in Life or whatever, you know, I still think The Blob is better. And I still think it's a fucking great, scary movie. It still has moments like the bath scene, like the telephone scene, where the editing and the cinematography and everything is working on a level that is just so effective and so palpable. And it just fucking rocks you. That part of me to this day, I think the only reason why I pursued the remake of The Blob was because I didn't want anyone else to just screw it up. Because I still think, like, and maybe, like, it would, if anyone's going to screw it up, it might as well be me, because I think that the original was so perfect that all I would want to do is compliment that. At the very least, if I make a blob that comes out, it'll just drive other people to see that one. So please just seek it out. I think it's on, like, iTunes now or whatever, but this movie is so worth your time. It is so worth being, you know, mentioned, and it is so much a worthy member of the Summer of 88 in the Junk Food Cinema Pantheon.
I agree. And now that we've done this episode, give it like 3 months and Shout Factory will put it out, because we have this weird ability.
Oh, you would be surprised. Oh, I can't say anymore.
I'm just saying, every fucking time we talk about it, did you hear that they're putting out Seventh Sign?
Seventh Sign, yeah.
I was like, what the fuck? Okay, this is getting spooky. Like, people kept pointing it out, like, it happens. And I was like, oh, it's coincidence. Seventh Sign, I was like, okay, this is like the 15th time this shit has happened.
And I'm like, to be fair, this is the 30th anniversary of the Seventh Sign.
Nope. It's awesome.
Which is, no, that is, I'm so glad you brought that movie up, because I forgot how potent that movie is. Like, that
the movie's
that,
really good.
And so again, it's one of those movies that, like, it was in Fango, and I think they did like two articles on it. I didn't really give it a lot of credence, and then I saw it, and oof, I can't. It's one of those ones I can't wait to revisit.
I wanted to mention this earlier. I'm really excited about the whole Fango relaunch. I mean, especially with the film festival culture that we've created.
Yeah.
You know, you read reviews online, you hear buzz on Twitter and Facebook and the like, and you get excited about this stuff, but not in the way you used to get with Fango. And to see that culture able to then translate that into Fangoria, yeah, and hype people up about these previously unknown horror movies and really get some still images of it and get some interviews with the people who worked on it and get into it and be hyped for the movie the minute it comes out in a way that you'd be hyped for anything from a studio, really excites me that we're going to get that chance again.
You know, what's really weird is that, you know, when we were growing up with Fango, this is a conversation that I've had with newer filmmakers, you know, like a few come up like right underneath us. And, you know, we were having this conversation once, and the topic of conventions came up, And it's weird when you look at like the Monster Paloozas and the Horror Hounds and the, you know, everything that's kind of spawned from Chiller Theater and also the Fangoria's Weekend of Horrors. Those conventions were spawned from fans wanting to see all of these great filmmakers and actors and also makeup effects artists and all the craftsmen that were behind it finally be able to meet them. And we knew about who those people were because of Fangoria, right? And because of Gore Zone and Toxic Horror and all that. And because Fango went away, but at the same time, while Fango kind of went away, this new cultural shift in horror kind of came up. But there were still conventions. There were still conventions going on. But if you look really closely, there's like all these great horror films of the last like 5 years. You don't see those filmmakers. And I know, look, you know, ignorance is bliss. Maybe I don't know as much about them because I'm not on the circuit proper all the time. But it just seems like a lot of those great filmmakers and effects people and actors that were doing, you know, who would do these normally aren't on those circuits. And I don't know whether it's like not cool or if it's like considered a cash grab or whatever, but the connection that we had as kids to your Bruce Campbells and your Robert Englunds and your Sam Raimis and your Gunnar Hansons and your Abel Ferraras, all these people that I met at all these Fangoria Weekend of Horrors, having Fango come back now, I think will make people appreciate practical effects and anything that you can capture like on the set, like practical effects and gore effects and stuff like that, all the things that we grew up with. I think that will just have this wonderful ripple effect where hopefully that will make more people want to do practical effects. It'll make those filmmakers want to go out and reach out to their fans a little bit more. I think it's like, whether we know it or not, I mean, Fango had a huge impact on the horror community and for a long time. And I mean, The Blob is, and I've heard people say The Blob is Fango porn, and they're not wrong, because, you know, there, I remember specific shots from that are maybe 8 frames in this movie, but I can describe bubbles on Tin Can Man when they pull the blanket back and you see his half dissolved self. Like, I remember vivid details on that and all the work that all these hardworking artists put into it. It's like, if Fango comes back, the appreciation will come back, hopefully with makeup effects, and that will make people want to do it more. And then hopefully those films will be hugely successful and make all of those artists go back on the convention. So keep up the good work, everybody. And hopefully Fango just kind of makes a lot more splatterpunks. I was waiting for it.
Speaking of conventions, thank you, Joe. Denver Comic Con this week, Friday, again, 8 o'clock. Cargill and I will be doing a live show on Monster Squad with Ryan Lambert and Andre Gower. I'm super excited about that.
Are they showing Wolfman's Got Nards?
They are showing Wolfman's Got Nards, in fact.
You'll see me in a few moments of that as well.
I have actually seen the film. There's a whole lot of Joe Lynch in there.
Miles and miles of Lynch. If you would like to catch up it is the podcast all about Joe Lynch.
Don't go any further. Don't.
And it's all about his penis. I was saying, if you want to track down our back catalog with more in-depth conversation about the length of Joe Lynch, Blog Talk Radio, and of course iTunes, rate and review us there. We really appreciate it. Follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And of course, if you really like the show more than we like Joe Lynch's cock, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and pledge your support there. We really appreciate it. Joe, where can people find you on the interwebs?
I've been taking a bit of a Twitter and Instagram sabbatical. Guys, it's been amazing. Update, the sky is blue. Fucking crazy. I can't.
It's weird.
Believe.
It's weird what happens when you look up from your phone.
It's amazing. But if and when I eventually get back on Twitter and Instagram, it's at the Joe Lynch.
But you also have, it's a podcast, right? What is it called again, Brian?
80s All Over.
It's the Movie Crypt.
I love that.
Come on, man.
I'm not doing it. I do it every fucking week. There's no way.
So do we, but we don't get paid for it.
funny enough, I love it. I driving into work and hearing you guys do the Movie Crypt thing is just gives me the biggest Cineboner. I love it. Funny enough,
yes, Joe has a great podcast. If you like us and you like Joe and you haven't listened to the episode where they interview me, it is seriously my favorite interview I've ever done.
It was a good one. Not maybe almost as good as this week's episode, which is the director of a Serbian film.
Which one? Which Serbian film?
The only Serbian film.
I'm just kidding. I know what you're talking about. Sorry.
We actually because Adam had never seen a Serbian film, so I recorded the first time he watched it. Oh my God. It's totally worth the view. Like, you don't, this is one of those episodes, because I know there's a lot of fan commentary tracks and stuff. This is definitely one you don't need to be watching the movie to listen to. Oh, it's juicy.
Oh boy. Speaking of Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
Well, I mean, you can find me wherever you buy books. This is the week, guys. I need you. My new book comes out, We're Where the Nightmares Go, 10 horror tales that range from dinosaurs trying to survive a zombie apocalypse to classic horror to a little bit of comedy. It is 10 horror tales all woven together, and you can find it on audio. You can find it in hard copy. You can find it digitally. And, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massawar.
Also, Where the Nightmares Go, into Adam Green's eyeballs as he watches a Serbian film for the first time. But, Joe, thank you so much for being here. Thanks for joining us for this movie and for making our summer of 88 complete, really. I mean, we don't have a lot of other places to go from here. So thank you so much, sir.
Keep it up, guys, because there's nothing that I like better than this kind of block of time that you guys have, because – And Cargill, I'm just going to say it. You got to do 89. I'm sorry. You're just going to have to do
89. No. Yes. No. Joe, you are not. Don't put you evil on me, Ricky Bobby.
Come on, dude. What is your aversion to 89?
Oh, he's talked about it. Don't make him do that again.
We'll talk about it later. But right now, we've got to end the show.
All right, fine.
So for Cargill, for Joe, this is Brian reminding you to always beware the bluff.